What value should we put on being polite? How important is it to be civil? And alternatively, how can civility and politeness and niceness be used to avoid real conversations, to avoid genuine disagreement, to avoid constructive dialogue and exchange? Can civility and politeness be a way to dodge confrontation, to avoid discomfort? And in a way to disrespect the person we're speaking to by allowing their bullshit to fly when really, if we respected them, we wouldn't? It's time for us to start practicing a little more than we do. The type of conversation that isn't banally civil and polite, nor overtly hostile. A conversation that stretches us, that challenges us, and that feels occasionally just a little, yes, uncomfortable. Today on the show, where do you even start with Scott Barry Kaufman? He has the number one psychology podcast in the world. It's called, believe it or not, The Psychology Podcast. So you can tell right there in the name that it's a podcast and it's about psychology. And then there's a definite article, The Psychology Podcast. Scott is fantastic. I've heard him around the traps a great deal because he's a terrific popularizer of science, but he's no lightweight, hackish popularizer. He is known in the psychology community, in the intellectual community, as someone who's done groundbreaking work on redefining intelligence. He has a PhD in cognitive psychology from Yale. He's the author of a number of books, one called Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind, Discover the 10 Things Great Artists, Writers, and Innovators Do Differently. Another one called Ungifted, Intelligence Redefined. Cognitive psychologist Scott Barry Kaufman offers a new way of looking at intelligence, the subtitle being The Truth About Talent, Practice, Creativity, and the Many Paths to Greatness. His most recent book is called Transcend, The New Science of Self-Actualization. This conversation could have gone in a million different ways. And as you will hear, we sort of bump and nudge and probe at each other's interesting little tidbits and nooks. But really, there are an infinite number of things that I would have liked to ask Scott about that I didn't have time to, like what is consciousness and why are we conscious in the first place and what is self-awareness and what is creativity. I hope to explore some of that perhaps on a future episode of the show, because this is really just an early taste that I hope you will find as brain tickling as I did into the mind of Scott Barry Kaufman.
That was the worst, though. That happened to me on my birthday.
Really?
Yeah, that happened to me on my last birthday. My dad came in from Philadelphia. We had this big dinner, and I was spent 80% of it in the bathroom. Yeah.
TMI.
Not good.
Scott, TMI.
I know. Well, I don't know. We haven't started the conversation yet, have we?
Oh, I'm recording already. This is going in for sure. Your explosive diarrhea is definitely going to make it into the final cut.
Okay, I don't know if you're serious or not.
Me neither. I mean, I am recording it. It's all up to my producer, out of my hands now. Can you do me a favor and do you have like a voice memos on your phone or something that you can do a backup recording of your side?
Oh, I can do better than that.
I'll bet you can.
I have this really, I'll do GarageBand. Hold on, let me open that.
Great.
So it'll be crystal clear. Now, I notice there's no video. That's so.
No.
I'm so used to like
I know.
Seeing the person. You're totally okay with us not seeing each other?
I'm totally okay with it.
Okay.
You know, I once read that that Terry Gross, you know, who does Fresh Air, only does never wants to see the face of the person she's talking to. So even when they get people into her studio, she puts them in another studio where they can't see each other.
Is it like implicit bias?
I think so. It's got something to do with the fact that the listener is only getting the sound. So, like, all of those kind of visual cues that you would normally take from a conversation somehow sort of impede the conversation. I don't know if that's true or not, but as a sort of radio person, I quite like
Well, I surely don't want you to be influenced by my dashing good looks.
That's right.
It would be very distracting. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, the fact that every time you speak, you wave your arms about and pull funny faces and try to distract
awkward,
me from my train of thought.
Awkward tick.
It's exactly that's right.
I didn't know you noticed that.
You crazy man.
Okay. I'm recording on my thing.
Great. Yeah. Good. Well, I was just going to say... I was thinking of you the other day because I was on my radio show and I had a caller call in and he was just talking about how dreadful the world is and how everything is awful and Ukraine and one of Australia's greatest sporting legends just died of a sudden heart attack at the age of 52 and there are floods in Australia and, you know, the end of the pandemic and everyone. And I was just like, I had to channel my inner Steven Pinker and kind of be like, you know what, actually, if you actually look at it and you actually look at the, you know, the statistics, then on all of the measures that we would care about, violence, poverty, disease, they're all down globally. There have been massive increases in education, in lifespan, in the amount of leisure time that we've got. We are safer than we've ever been. And he was like, yeah, but it doesn't make us happy. And I thought, I'll bet Scott's got some ideas about why. Why aren't we happy, Scott?
Well, I think it's because we're trying to chase happiness. I mean, that's like the biggest paradox of them all, is we think that something's wrong with us when we're not feeling happy. And so then we're like, oh my God, we got to do something right now to get us happy. And then all the things we do to get happy, we make us unhappy.
Like what?
Yeah, well, there's various things that we can be solving for, right? So solving for happiness means like you're trying to solve for how can I get back good feelings. If you're solving for meaning, it's, well, what can I do in my life that will make me feel like it's meaningful, that it's worth it, that there's something, that things are connected, there's a coherency there. If you solve for experiences, some people want to live their life solving for just an experientially rich life. And so they're jumping out of airplanes. They're doing all weird, sort of weird sexual positions, whatever.
With explosive diarrhea. Now we're on to tantric sexual positions. Yeah. Scott, yeah. You're bringing
well, that's
it today.
Part of I think it's part of living an experientially rich life, quite frankly.
The diarrhea or the sex?
No, the latter. Well, I mean, okay. Well, the former was a growth experience too, I would say. So all of it, I'm going to say. So it's like, what are you trying to solve for? And so if you're trying to solve for happiness, you might be like, okay, well, if I eat this pizza right now, that's going to make me feel really good in the moment. You know, if you're trying to solve for happiness to restore that feeling of a good feeling in some way, well, it's really kind of like a temporary solution. I view meaning as a much more sustainable long-term solution, and even just experientially rich and complex and challenging thing. So I include having difficult conversations as part of living experientially rich life. And I think solving for that is going to lead to more meaning and in the long run is going to be more sustainable in terms of a sense of less of a sense of urgency, less of a sense of this kind of pressure you put on yourself to be happy. Because when you're putting a lot of pressure on yourself if you want to be happy all the time. That's a lot of pressure. And that is making people so stressed out. It's paradoxical.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember. I think it might have been Oliver Berkman who I love,
yeah,
who
love
said,
him. Yeah.
"Yeah, he said he." I may be misattributing this to him, but if I am, I'm sure he'll take the compliment because it's a good point. That happiness is a little bit like a bar of soap in the shower. Like the more you squeeze it, the more likely it is to kind of slip out of your hand, and the more elusive it becomes. You have to have a gentle touch with happiness, and in actual fact, that happiness is sort of a byproduct of other pursuits, that pursuing happiness directly is it's almost like going towards a light that you're never going to be able to approach. It's better if you just sort of allow it to arise as a consequence of being useful.
Yeah, I think that's really correct. And what's his name, Anthony Bourdain, the chef who passed away. I was watching the documentary about him, and I was just so fascinated. I believe it was Roadrunner. And there's a scene at the end that just really struck me where he's in a canoe of some sort in a foreign country. He looks so relaxed and he looks around. He's like, huh, I'm happy. And it's like a huge shock, you know, that like it wasn't something he forced, right? It was like it was a moment. I think happiness are just moments, and if you're, you know, you get them and they come and they emerge from the kind of meaning we put in, from opportunities that we can get to actually feel whole, to feel relaxed. I mean, there's a lot of things we can do where we can increase the likelihood that happiness will emerge. I'm certainly not saying that happiness is a terrible goal. I'm not anti-happiness. I'm not saying, oh, you should do everything that'll make you unhappy. But I'm saying you can do things to increase the chances that you can get into every now and then. That's pretty good life if every now and then you can get in those states, those moments, even a whole day where you're like, look around you and you're like, huh, like, wow, like I'm happy right now. Look at that. Look at that.
I mean, it's funny you mentioned Bourdain because A, the man killed himself.
Exactly.
B, exactly. He was a hero of mine, and I actually wrote a little eulogy after he died, just saying that, just making the point that he had everything that I could ever want in life. I mean, I love to travel. I love food. I loved his way with words, his eloquence, his kind of debonair, like Renaissance man attitude towards everything, his hedonism, his he influenced me a lot in my creative output in the sense that he was such a breath of fresh air in not taking any bullshit and speaking plainly and directly and allowing his sort of sparkle to shine brighter than the conformist ways that we're supposed to talk to one another or the polite ways that you're supposed to talk about things. You know, he was really averse to cliche and to conformism. And my point was just that you can have all of that. You can have, you know, a loving partner. You can have a little daughter. You can have these, you know, first class or business class flights to wherever you want to go in the world, producing your own creative output, eating amazing food, meeting amazing people, seeing amazing things. And at the end of the day, all that matters is what's going on between your ears. You can be miserable as a millionaire on a mega yacht, and you can be happy in a wheelchair. And everything outside is always subject to our gray matter's interpretation of it. And his suicide was just such a stark and crushing reminder of that fact. So how do you avoid that fate?
Well, first of all, have you met him?
No.
Did you meet him? You never got a chance the existences to intersect.
No. Great regret.
It's you're bringing up so many good points. But what was your pointed question?
I guess, how do you make sure that what's going on in your life actually has an impact on your subjective sense of happiness? Well, maybe it shouldn't. Maybe that's not the right way of thinking.
It shouldn't. Yeah, that's putting way too much pressure. People put so much pressure on themselves. Like, what's my call? What's my purpose? What's my purpose? I don't have a purpose. Therefore, my life is meaningless. And I think even just that framing is just like, whoa, way too much pressure, buddy. Like, you can have meaning in like just walking by a flower. You can have meaning in being mindful when you're eating your pudding. I don't know, any kind of food. I don't know why pudding entered my mind. Whatever, you're eating.
For our English listeners, pudding means, I think, have you noticed that in English?
Yeah,
English,
that's like disgusting, English, right? It's like,
No.
Black pudding is a thing, right? Yeah.
That's a thing. But in British English, pudding just means anything sweet. So
you're like, okay, there you go. That works.
Say, can I have my pudding? And like, but for me, if they're bringing out a creme caramel, it's not a pudding. For me, a pudding is...
Yeah.
It has to be more pudding-like. It has to be a mousse. Anyway, let's not get sidetracked
by pudding. Fair enough. We can get into the nuances of that, but I think let's just pretend that I meant the English definition and proceed from there. Okay, and proceed from there. You know, but this is the thing that it's my thing, is helping people realize that there's so much potential sources of meaning and beauty around them already that already exists. We feel this pressure to constantly get new things. What is my new purpose, or what is a new purchase I could make that will make me happy? Well, I'm not going to lie. There are some purchases I make that do make me happy for at least 2 days, So that's something. But in the long term,
anti-diarrheals, you know, for example.
Oh my god! So we like, I feel like you made the executive decision that we're keeping that beginning in, or else you're gonna have to edit out like 50% of the interview.
Now, yeah,
so.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
You're just like reinforcing it. You committed to it.
I'm stitching the diarrhea through so many juncture points of the conversation that it will henceforth become impossible for my producer to cut out.
I see what you're doing. Like
I'm just embedding calling it out. Yes, that's right. Yeah. I'm a Ukrainian defensive force just embedding landmines beyond the front line.
Yeah, exactly what I was saying.
Okay. So you can buy. Yeah. I mean, should we start? Should we get to Maslow or Maslow? Is it Maslow or Maslow?
I think it's Maslow.
Maslow. I was right up, off on both counts. About whom you've basically written an entire book. Remind people who he was and what his insight was.
So Abraham Maslow was a humanistic psychologist who basically created the humanistic psychology movement in the 50s and 60s. And there were a bunch of other humanistic psychologists around that time as well that were part of the movement, who they all believed in understanding the whole human, not just our naughty bits, but our higher nature. They felt that psychology prior to that time had focused, had neglected the higher nature of humans and focused so much on what we share with other animals, not necessarily what uniquely human, what is human potential, right? So that's what they're really interested in. And so Abraham Maslow was one of the leaders of that human potential movement in that era, which was intimately tied to the hippies, to Esalen Institute, to San Francisco, and that whole hippy dippy thing, you know. So all that stuff was part of the zeitgeist. What I'm trying to do is carry the baton, and, you know, and I run the Center for Human Potential, and I'm trying to see what a modern day human potential movement could look like.
What was his hierarchy of needs?
Like personally, or his theory?
No, his theory.
His theory. Gotcha. That's a personal question about him. But that time you met Maslow, tell us the
number
truth.
Number one was pudding. Imodium.
Well, some people look. Some people on the internet have memes right at the bottom for COVID. It was toilet paper. Right. Remember when COVID started and like no one could find.
And this is like, if people envisage like the pyramid, if they've never studied the psychology, then the Maslow. He has a pyramid, like you might have a food pyramid or something, with the baseline necessities at the bottom, and then I suppose the luxuries at the top.
Yeah, I wouldn't say luxuries. So self-actualization really was the only thing he had there at the top. So the way it's usually depicted is that, like you said, there's a pyramid, and at the bottom you have basic need for food, shelter, water, and then above that you have need for connection and belonging. I missed a level. Below connection is a need for security, feeling like your environment is safe and secure. And then above that is connection and belonging. And above that is self-esteem. And the esteem needs, he called them the esteem needs, not just self-esteem, but esteem for yourself, but also esteem from others. And then above that was self-actualization, which is becoming all you're uniquely capable of becoming. However, so it turns out he never drew a pyramid. Turns out he never drew a pyramid. There's really? Nothing in his writings. So I was going through all his writings. I was like, where's the pyramid? Where is it? And he never drew a pyramid. So a huge misconception I tried to put in my book, and which is why I came up with a new metaphor, which I think is a better hierarchy of needs metaphor than the one that's been going around for like 50 years. He very much made it clear that life is not like a video game where you reach a certain level, like need for security, and then you hear some voice from above that's like, congrats, you've unlocked family. And you you move up in some sort of way, like some trek up a mountain. I've reconceptualized it as a sailboat, in the sense that, you know, where life is to be experienced, not to be climbed and integrated, you know, like a sailboat that has a really secure foundation of the boat, that no holes, the water isn't coming in, but also that opens its sail and explores.
Right, but the sailboat needs, so in this metaphor, the coherence or the stability, the security of the sailboat would be things like security, right? I mean, you still need the bottom bits of the pyramid for the sailboat not to sink.
Yes. So in the boat, I have the need for security, need for connection, and the need for self-esteem. These three things feed off each other in really, really important ways. They're a system they're a boat. When you feel like any one of those three is critically low, it tends to bring those other two down with it, and you feel like you're not standing on a firm foundation of your being.
The three being security, connection, and what?
Self-esteem.
Self-esteem. Let's talk about connection, because security, well, we'll get to self-esteem. I think security we can probably park, because unless we're listening in a situation of dire poverty, in which case, how are you listening to my podcast? Or unless we're in Ukraine or something, most of us have a modicum of security in the modern world. But what has been upended over the past couple of years with the pandemic so much is connection. And what is also being disrupted by social media and our online lives is connection. How are we doing on that front?
Oh, terrible. Absolutely terrible. There are real crises, whatever. There's a huge crisis of loneliness, and certain age groups and certain demographics are showing it more. You can really get to the nuance of it. Research shows that males are like young adulthood males are particularly really, really, really lonely. It's very hard for them to make friends after a certain age, like after 40. So they're showing huge loneliness. But then college students, they're, you know, regardless of the gender, there's huge anxiety and loneliness. It's very hard for college students to have meaningful connections with each other. There's a lot of superficial things going on, you know, like frat parties and stuff, but meaningful connections. And so this is a real big problem. And the question is, how can you structure a society and are there societies that don't show this? And there are some societies that have been studied, and you try to learn what are the lessons, well, you know, what are the lessons you can learn. And what you see in those societies is, A, there's much less of a focus on social media. I mean, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention social media as a potential
problem.
Yeah,
no, right? I definitely want to get to that. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. And you see a bunch of things. You see more care for the elderly. You see, you don't just shut them away. You know, in America, it's like after a certain age, after 70, it's like you can't find a job anywhere, right? As opposed to be like, oh,
70.
What's the next?
I mean, you know, it's 50.
Yeah. 50, yeah, maybe even 50.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, like if you're a 54-year-old, it is tough, unless you're a senior executive level. It's tough.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's right.
One of the ways that younger people find connection, talking about that that college cohort, is you know, if we don't provide some sort of connection, some sense of fulfillment and like development for that cohort, especially young males, then you do tend to find them ganging together and teaming up and creating their own versions of meaning, which can be unproductive, or being taken under the wing of unscrupulous people, joining alt-right movements, maybe the far right, maybe the far left, maybe becoming revolutionaries, maybe becoming violent gangs, maybe careening off into drugs. Like, what? How do you sort of corral that instinct for that craving for connection among young people in productive ways?
There are many, many ways of launching off that question. The male specific thing has its own sort of set of. That's a whole like can of worms, right? That's a whole topic of conversation, which I'm happy to open if you'd like.
Yeah, I love opening cans of worms. That's the point of the show.
Oh yeah, that's. I mean, if I'm going to ever open this can of worms, it's going to be in your show. It's going to be in your show. I want to have a very thoughtful answer to this. But it's you know, it's definitely a can of worms. There's I do think identity is important, and I think having a healthy, and I've argued for having a healthy pride for your in group, and I've distinguished that from narcissistic pride for your in group, and that's a topic. But I think that part of the loneliness is, you know, groups of people that have feel real difficulty in creating identity for who they are. You know, there's a lot of positive affirmations for identities within the LGBT, you know, Q community. It's a long alphabet now. I don't know. I remember. I just don't have memorized the whole thing. I'm sorry. I don't. But in that, if you're part of,
just as an aside, Scott, my partner will, like, every time he talks about anything regarding the gay community, he'll literally call it the LGBTQI plus QIA LGBTQIA plus. And like, I'm like, how are you? I'm like, we're in the kitchen. Come on. You don't have to be using that jargon right here. Just call them, just call it gay or queer or something. Like, what are we giving it?
Well, I just saw the other day, I saw someone like post the latest one and it's 40. I think it's like up to 40 letters
now.
Yeah,
too much. We need a catch-all. Yeah. Come on. I mean, I understand that you're all very important little sunflowers in this, in this, in this world.
Yeah, exactly.
But do we have to call you out by name? It's like instead of saying ladies and gentlemen, we're going to say Andrea and Bob and Charlie and go through a hall full of 1,000 people. Everyone gets their own special little.
No, I agree, and I want to make this point thoughtfully and sensitively, but I do want to make this point. You know, if you're anywhere in that alphabet now, it's almost like it's like a pre-made identity where you can find meaning, right? You can say, you know, it's a sense of pride, right? It's like I'm the Z. I don't know if Z is yet in the alphabet, but it's like, but it's also kind of sending a message in a way where. Like, what if we get to the point where you have literally every letter in the alphabet except for white male? Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, it's getting the point where it's like, wait, what are you saying? Like, just say it. You don't like white males. Just say it. And or you don't like straight, I should say cisgender white males, I should say.
Cisgender. I don't think the white comes in that particular conjunction.
No, it's just cisgender. Cisgender.
But I mean, they would say, of course, that it has nothing to do with not liking. It's just about, you know, finding your identity and self-expression in a way that is in a place that is welcoming.
I totally know what they would say, and I don't even think that's wrong. I mean, I can be on board with exactly that framing.
I mean, I personally think it's wrong because I personally, as someone who's married to another guy, I personally have always found it disempowering to be, to have to conform to some kind of conception of what gayness is, and so I actually he and I always, you know, have playful disagreements about this. I think in the future, in the same way, this is a bit of a tangent, but in the same way that in the future, if there is a world in which we can, in which white people can talk about how horrible the N-word is without having to say the phrase the N-word, but actually say the word, that will be a less racist, not a more racist future, almost by definition, because the word won't have its sting, the word won't have its supernatural power. And in the same way, a world in which a 15-year-old jock at high school can date a girl and then maybe the next year date a guy, and there isn't constant like whispering and questioning of like, so where are you in the alphabet? Like, what exactly are you? Will be a less homophobic world, I think, not more. So I would rather lean away from the identity buckets and lean towards a more expansive conception of individualism and sort of common humanity and the sanctity of everybody for whoever they happen to be, regardless of what, you know, label you want to put on them. But that's that. Perhaps that's a conversation for another day, or perhaps you want to take that somewhere too.
I don't think that's a conversation for another day. Actually, I think it's so in line with just something I think of obsessively, which is, what does true inclusion look like? Like true inclusion, you know, where you don't apply principles selectively based on your in-group. And I think about that so much because I'm all about having us view each other as a human first before the identity. You know, like leading with that sort of leading with the common humanity. Mm. I'm all about that. I mean, I'm a humanistic psychologist. That's on brand for me to say that. but I try to think of what is true inclusivity, and something has never sat right with me with the alphabet or with it. I've never really been able to articulate quite well. It just doesn't feel like true inclusivity to me. Like a true inclusivity would be, you know, what sits better to me are things like, hey, we're having a meeting Friday, and I just want you to know, like, everyone is welcome here. And just saying that, like, why can't you, like, but instead, when you start, like, singling out the ones that are included, then it's just, you're like, well, you're excluding some people. And then, of course, they can make the point, well, we've historically been the ones that are excluded, but I don't believe two wrongs ever make a right, you know? So I think that kind of just, I'd rather just constantly be sending the message to everyone that, like, you're all welcome here. And that's it. Right. Like, just stop. Period. Put the period there.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. And if your mindset is one of constantly trying to poke holes in other people's, in interpreting their message in bad faith and poke holes in what they're doing, then no solution will ever be enough. I mean, you could say everyone is welcome here. And then you could say, well, what about people with dual personality disorders? You said everyone. Like, what about people who, or what, you know, you're only talking about Homo sapiens are you? What about my, turtles. You know, my ferret or my turtle or something who's here? Like, you're being exclusionary in some, like, you're always going to be able to fault someone if your mode of interacting with the world is to pick out faults. So I almost feel like it's fundamentally a futile mission. And I wonder whether you have thoughts about that as well, the fulfillment that can come from a certain grace.
Well, I've personally have found that it's possible. I run a Transcend course. I've taught in colleges, I've taught at probably the most woke college in the world. And the reason why I think it works, it's the spirit you bring to the table. You know, I make it very clear on the first day of class, you know, I'm here to help each of you self-actualize in your own way. That's my intention. And in order to do that, I want to understand you as a unique human with your own unique, full human complexity. Like, to me, that's what's really interesting to me, is the full human complexity, not just the singular identity that's one part of you. And just setting that tone, like, you're all welcome here, and each of your individual self-actualizing journeys are welcome here. It shifts the focus from, well, okay, we have this group in the corner here. Okay, all the LBT people are on the far right here, the far left are all, this is the football team.
Yeah.
No. What it does is it just shifts the focus in a way that no one gets defensive with that, because at the end of the day, that's what individuals want. You know, like, that's what each human wants, you know?
What is exactly?
What is it that human wants?
What do they want? Yeah.
They want to actualize their potential. I mean, they want to actualize their unique creative potential. They want to feel like they matter. I mean, the need to matter is what we're seeing so much underneath so much of the conflict we see everywhere we turn our heads these days. And people are acting as though their unique vulnerabilities are the most important vulnerabilities in the world. So we've created kind of a hierarchy of suffering, when underneath it all are just people with severely deficient feelings of the need to matter, trying to have a voice.
Right. Yeah, I call it the oppression Olympics. Like, you know, everyone's competing for how oppressed they are, or how wronged they've been, or what group they can associate themselves with that has been persecuted. You know, it's the easiest move in the world for me to slough off my white cis male cloak and embrace my grandson of Holocaust surviving Jews and member of the LGBTQIA plus community cloak. Mm. And that suddenly gets me cred, right? Because I belong to a couple of oppressed communities, so I can sort of show those flashcards that give me the right to speak, which is completely noxious, because my white maleness should not undermine my sanctity as a human being any more than my being a gay Jew buys it for me.
That's exactly right. It's the I call it the victimhood Olympics, which is very up the alley of what you're saying as well. But the problem with that clearly is that when you start competing in that Olympics, there's only one winner. Just like the Olympics, right? It's suddenly a competition, and that is not productive. There are more productive ways of engaging with your fellow human that has their own unique set of sufferings and things they feel victimhood over. I am constantly just in awe and amazement at watching battles unfold on Twitter.
If there are more productive ways, they must be more elusive. Otherwise, people wouldn't be behaving the way they are.
Elusive. Well, there's
like more difficult to find, right? I mean, why are people doing it if it weren't scratching an itch?
Well, people are definitely suffering, and I don't want to diminish that. And when you're in the state of deprivation, this is what I write about the whole theory that that Maslow talked about, really talking about the difference between deficiency motivation and growth motivation. They're two completely different realms of human existence. So many of us are caught in the deficiency trap, where it's so hard for us to feel or see a way out or to call ourselves out of it, because that system of self-esteem, connection, and security are so low that we're just fighting to just get those to baseline. And when you're in that mindset, you're not thinking about engaging someone for the purpose of growth. It's almost like growth is a luxury at that point. So it makes sense from a hierarchical need structure of human motivations.
Hmm. That's interesting. It doesn't mean we can't
call our way out or to shift the focus to growth.
I mean, I'm just interrogating internally now what it feels like when I'm owning someone on Twitter.
Yeah.
Versus what it feels like when I'm doing something that is closer to the pursuit of, you know, the self-actualization of humankind. And the latter is harder, less instantly gratifying, perhaps more fulfilling in the long run. But it is fun to dunk on someone on Twitter too.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's also fun to eat fatty foods, you know, pizza. Like, you know, like, there are a lot of things that are definitely immediately fun. Right. and more rewarding in the moment. I see that too. I'm on social media. Anytime I try to pull on the one hand and on the other hand, it's like four likes. But then if I like, I'm feeling particularly grumpy and I'm like, that person is a whack ass motherfucker. People are like, 5,000 likes. Wow. Yeah. Go Scott. You know, it's like, so it's true. I mean, it's true.
I want to see that tweet of yours. I want to see
that person's Scott a whack ass motherfucker.
Yeah, exactly. Where's that one? The whack ass motherfucker tweet.
That happened to me a couple months ago. I let something slip. You know, someone just really pissed me off. But the funny thing about that story is you were involved in that in exactly that moment. Yeah. You were in exactly that moment. Brett Weinstein was criticizing your tweet when you were looking into the science of, and you really, I really appreciated the thoughtfulness of how you contacted a leading cardiologist, and you had this very thoughtful thread. And then he retweeted something like, "This guy's part of," again, another person who's a smart person who went to the dark side or something. And I went, and I lost it. It's so funny because you're the one involved in this. Yeah. I don't know if you saw, but I responded to Brett. I really lost it.
Now that I had forgotten about that, but now, I mean, that whole period is, needless to say, a blur of tweets.
You wanted to repress that memory.
That's right, yeah.
But it upset me at a very deep level because I really appreciate people who take the time to look at multiple sides and to consult an expert and to try to share knowledge. So that really upset me that he was diminishing that. And my normal sort of gates of on the one hand, on the other hand, kind of went off. It was 10 p.m. at night as well. I've tried to maybe now have a rule not to tweet after 7 p.m. because you know, the inhibition's lower. And I kind of regret the way I responded to Brett. And Brett responded to, like, well, that was entirely out of character for you. And I was like, okay.
Well, good. Yeah. I mean, but your character is so endlessly, infinitely polite, Scott, that I think if you dial up your rudeness by 10%, that's still
I didn't get canceled.
More polite.
Brett didn't cancel me, so that's good.
Also, it is just frustrating when people have such self-certainty about their own point of view. Like, you know, people picking apart the opinion, and if people aren't aware of the backstory here, I was on Joe Rogan's show. Joe and I got into a dispute about whether or not the rate of heart inflammation from getting the vaccine is higher or lower than the rate of heart inflammation from getting COVID itself. Brett Weinstein is obviously highly skeptical of vaccines and a big pusher of misinformation about the pandemic and about vaccines. So I followed up, because I'm not a scientist, so I followed up with the leading, I mean, I called like the Cardiology Institute, not the Vaccine Institute of Australia or something, but the Cardiology Institute of Australia, just to get the actual facts about the heart impacts of the vaccine versus COVID. Did a half-hour interview with this guy just to, and so for me, that's kind of the end of it from my point of view. Like, if a leading cardiologist who represents the mainstream bulk of scientific opinion on the matter and is best informed about the latest science of it, I'm just not going to do my own research, so to speak, beyond that. Like, I'm not going to be digging. I don't know, and none of us knows unless we're trained academic experts, how to pass the data of one paper versus another paper. So I think it's ridiculous that Twitter is so awash with people like sharing, you know, pre-publication, you know, pre-peer-reviewed papers about ivermectin or something without the humility to understand that they don't understand really the context into which that paper is dropping, the other papers. You know, you have to rely on experts. So the idea that I would go to the expert, do a Twitter thread simply outlining what the expert had said and then close the book on it. And then people pop up and go, yeah, but how do you know that blah, 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 study from June, like 2020.
Oh, I know.
I'm like, I don't fucking know that.
But how do you know?
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. All I know is that I'm the one with some epistemic humility here, and you're mouthing off like a jackass as if you know everything and you're impervious to further correction.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts about that. One is that whole Twitter thing and me losing it actually led to this, us getting to talk to each other, and led to me reaching out to you, led to this podcast chat. So I don't regret it.
Yeah,
you know,
it led to this
great connection here. Right. Yeah. You know, and looking forward to having you in my podcast as well. What that moment did for me is I thought to myself, I really like that person's way of being. That person being you. I really liked that, and it resonated my own sort of way of being. I also reached out to Eric Topol. I did something similar, and I invited him to be on my podcast, and that episode has been released recently and has been awesome, and that was a really great chat. And I mean I wasn't like over appeasing. I asked him some tough questions, and the way he answered them is exactly how a scientist should answer them. You know, like, there's a way that a scientist answers questions, right? An expert in a field. You know the true experts when they're not like, I know the secret truth that no one else knows. Mm. That's not usually how the real expert talks. Mm.
Yes, and the real expert doesn't hint darkly at things that they're not suggesting, but that you might be able to read between the lines, right, and imply, yeah, you know, like, yeah, Robert Malone did, yeah, on, yeah, Joe Rogan's, yeah, show. Like, I can just tell a hack. I'm sorry, I can smell it. I've interviewed too many people, and as you say, real scientists don't talk. They don't hint at things. You know, they're very rational, and they'll qualify things, and they'll say, well, we don't know this, we don't know that, but they won't say, well, you know, I'm not saying, but you might want to say that bloody blah behind the scenes. Like, that's not a scientist.
And they tend to also do the one hand, on the other hand things, and that's a tell that you're actually a scientist or a scholar. Even just like, look, I think we're really losing the scholarly mindset in the world. Not just scientist mindset, but there's a certain like scholarly, and I know that's a really truly nerdy thing to say, right? Like, and almost like academic elitist sort of thing to say. But I think anyone, if they want to have that mindset, you know, there's a way of thinking where you're interested in the truth, you're interested in integrating multiple sources, as many data points as possible, to kind of see what that integration looks like. That's a certain scholarly mindset. I think we've lost that. I don't know if we ever
had
it.
Have we lost it partly because of the democratization of information? I mean, I'm trying to grapple with this whole concept of doing your own research and being skeptical of traditional gatekeepers of information in the media and in government and so on. And I'm coming to feel that one of the worst things that's happened in the social media information revolution is the growth of taking responsibility for your own opinion about things in an overboard way. So like the do your own research phenomenon. I mean, nobody knows more about the details of what happened on November 22nd, 1963, was it, than JFK conspiracy theorists.
Yeah.
Right? They've done all of the research.
It's true.
You know, they know a lot more about it than you do. They know exactly where the gun was pointing and all this. And a lot of what they know is probably correct. And from those nuggets of truth, they weave a castle in the sky of like all of these, these theories about exactly what happened and how they know the secret truth. Same with 9/11 truthers. You know, they can tell you what material was Building 7 made out of. I don't fucking know. You don't know. I'll bet a 9/11 truther knows.
Wait, hold
on.
So
there's a lot, you know.
Do you think they really know the most on the whole? I don't think that. I would push back that against that, because I think that when I hear conspiracy theorists, they're almost like nerds about a specific aspect of the whole truth. But I don't find that they tend to ever really look at the competing information and try to integrate it. I don't see a scholarly mindset there at all, actually.
No, that's kind of what I mean. Like, is the scholarly mindset undermined by an undue fixation on detail, on doing one's own research, on finding out the truth? Because at some point, the reality is that I don't have a scholarly mindset because I'm not an expert in any field. I'm just a conversationalist and someone who likes to draw out the opinions of smarter people than me or more expert people than me. And as a result, I relinquish my duty to do too much research into things, and I outsource my opinions essentially to the people who do have a scholarly mindset.
I think you but do have a lot scholarly of people... mindset.
Oh, really? Yeah, what does that I mean do. Then?
I think scholarly mindset is like a domain general kind of mindset that's not, you don't have to have the knowledge in the field to have one. And it's a whole method and way of acquiring information. So you can have no scholarly, you can have no knowledge of epidemiology or cardiology. Like I'm not an expert in cardiology, but I was just curious, like, okay, what does the truth say about myocarditis? Well, I just go on Google Scholar and I opened up 150 tabs. I looked at the abstracts. It's knowing how to interpret data. It's knowing how to interpret research.
I don't. If I opened 150 tabs about myocarditis, I would get confused, and I would probably assume, and there would be enough in there that led me astray that I would probably start thinking maybe there is something in this. Sure. I need the insider to contextualize it for me and go. Yeah, although this piece says that there's actually a higher incidence, what you're not understanding is that that's offset by over here this epidemiological thing that showed that blah de blah, and because the cohort was different here, that what you're not understanding is that in Israel they actually only gave it to these people. Like, there's a lot of all that qualifying scaffolding that I would not be aware of, and I worry that sometimes the details overwhelm the larger truth.
But you're thoughtful. Can I say that at least? Would you accept a compliment?
Definitely.
Because when I think scholarly mindset, maybe my example is too high level, but I think that I associate with thoughtfulness, which is simple understanding the nuances of a situation, understanding that the more data you can acquire about something, the more likely you are to get at the truth in an unbiased way of acquiring the data, not only trying to go down a rabbit hole and find all the data that confirms your prior conception, but being like a robot about it, like just opening up the 150 tabs of whatever we're talking about, you know, and looking at every single perspective and looking into try to think, well, what does the weight of the evidence really say, not what I want it to be.
But is it true, Scott, that you get most of your information about things by going directly to the data? I mean, like, is your opinion about whether 9/11 was an inside job driven by your, deep examination of data?
Yeah. And I went down that rabbit hole once.
Really?
And I did. I also, by the way, the JFK thing, I really went down that rabbit hole because I wanted to know what the truth was about that. Right. But just the 9/11 thing, I think part of the acquiring the information is also seeking out experts. So that's part of my point as well. Like right. Very thoughtful. I mean, it was scholarly, dare I say. I don't know. Maybe you don't like that word.
Right.
But you know, when I acquire as much information as possible about something, I'm also including that in that data set as much of what the experts think is the truth.
Right. Oh, certainly. Look, I'm not averse to being called a scholar or a wizard or a king. I just don't want to take any credit away from actual, you know, people who've gone through the hard yards of doing
PhD
and something.
Experts are different than scholars. I think some experts cannot be scholars.
Could I pass as a king?
You know, no.
but like 9/11 is a good example because, say, you know, 9/11, I was completely open to the possibility that there was something fishy going on. And then there was one article in Popular Science magazine where they finally, you know, were like, okay, let's actually examine all of the conspiracy theories about this. And they got all the experts together and they wrote this big, huge feature piece. I think it like took up the entire magazine. I read that one piece and then I was like, okay, I'm not going to think about this anymore. I'm not going to dive into the data. I'm not going to look up any papers. I'm not going to look up anything peer-reviewed. I trust Popular Science. I certainly trust all of the people who are writing here more than I trust the conspiracy theorists. So as far as I'm concerned, I've outsourced my thinking on this to people who know more than me.
Yeah, I like what you're saying. And I think it's also important to really look at where the controversies lie among the experts within the field. So for instance, if there's pretty much a scientific consensus, I'm not – It's those cases where I don't tend to need to look for much, much further. But there are some really nuanced debates within fields among experts, and that's what really interests me sometimes. Like I get really stimulated and really can go down that rabbit holes where it's not really agreed upon an interpretation of certain data. And then that does leave room open, not for conspiracy theories, but it leaves room open for not having complete faith or trust in a particular interpretation by one set of experts.
That's good. Yeah, that's true. Let's loop back to social media because I definitely want to get your thoughts on it. And we can either put this in the context of our sort of hierarchy of needs and work our way back to the basic sort of punchline of your book about self-actualization and transcendence, actually, let's start with the fast food analogy because you raised it and I think it's a good one about the, mm-hmm. I guess the speed of our gratification that social media facilitates and how that's impacting the way that we think about our lives and the world.
I think that likes have become a major source of power in people's life. Can you imagine the power? I'm not there yet, but you know how there are some people like they can just say one sentence and then immediately gets like 50,000 likes. it could be like a platitude. It can be like the dumbest statement. It could even be the same exact statement you wrote the day before, but you got like 5 likes. And then you're looking at the other person, you know, like you say something, you know, I'll say something like happiness emerges as a product of meaning, right? It's like, you know, 10 likes. And then I'll see like some really famous self-help guru or someone. They said the same sentence and it's 50,000 likes. There's actually an existential question there now. If this is a philosophical question, like, so does their life have more value than mine? Because them saying the sentence has 50,000 likes, whereas mine has 5.
Need to know what people are doing or what people think they're doing when they're tapping the like, wouldn't you?
What do you mean?
Well, so like, you know, to determine whether or not in some grand philosophical
sense. Are they like masturbating or something? Yeah. While they type it? Is that what you're saying?
No.
What are they doing exactly?
No, Scott, that's not what I was saying, Scott. Okay. No, I just mean, so if let's say, you know, Bieber tweet something. That's such an old man's reference for what young people like. He's probably 40 years old by now, but you know,
Can you imagine Bieber at age 80, by the way? Can you imagine that?
Yeah. He's still going to be cute. He'll still be adorable.
I guess so. Yeah.
And,
I guess
so. Yeah. But whoever the modern day Bieber is, I don't even know who that is. Who is that?
You're not even
with
know.
The young kids these days. Siri, who is the modern day Bieber? No, got nothing. Anyway,
a good question. I don't know. But anyway, let's pretend there's
probably
someone.
I mean, I guess like Billie Eilish is the only person who I can think of who's actually young and is also really talented and famous.
Okay, let's talk about Billie Eilish.
So let's say that Billie Eilish, you know, tweets out, you know, happiness is the holy grail and gets 50,000 likes, and you do that and you get five likes. The question of whether or not you're worth less than Billy hinges for me on whether or not those people who are liking her tweet are voting for a deep sense of gratitude, fulfillment, and perspective, or whether they're just going, I like Billy.
Yeah. Well, that's part of it, is that we have equated, that's part of the point I'm trying to make in a cheeky way, but is that we are equating likes on social media, so we're so caught in the social status trap that we're starting to bound up our own sort of sense of self-worth to the extent to which people are like, yeah, I like that person on social media. And that's a huge problem. That's a huge problem psychologically for the higher values and the higher needs to be fulfilled. It's what it is. It's keeping us in that D realm, as Maslow called it, the deficiency realm of human existence, which doesn't allow us to kind of get out of that to have growth options that may not get us many likes on social media, but in the real world, we're growing.
Right. Yeah. What's the deficiency realm?
Yeah. So the deficiency realm is when you're making decisions in your life and you're living your life and doing certain actions in order to relieve some hole in your heart, relieve some deficiency, whether it's a deficiency of connection, deficiency of self-esteem. And that's what I'm seeing a lot of is a lot of this stuff is for self-esteem motive. The likes are really, really tapping into that dopamine circuit or the need for security or feeling insecure.
People talk a lot, Scott, about the hedonic treadmill. Well, people don't talk about it a lot, but it's a thing that people are aware of, right? You know, everyone's aware that, you know, you get the new job and then that's fun and fulfilling for 6 months, and then it becomes the new baseline normal and you need some new achievement or some new trinket, some new distraction. My mum once had a T-shirt that said, "He who dies with the most toys wins." And, you know, that's a good example of the hedonic treadmill.
Yeah.
But as I hear you talk about self-esteem, I wonder if there's a self-esteem treadmill.
Treadmill.
Yes. You know, like.
Yeah, I think there is. And that's a brilliant phrase. You should coin that right now.
Okay. Trademarked.
But it's, your trademark. Yeah. Because you did coin it. And I like that. I think that's what we're seeing a lot on social media. And I think it explains the reward value incentives for fighting on social media. People are rewarded for the fighting. People are rewarded for taking down someone else, for viewing people as opponents, for gathering your own tribe and rallying them, you know, to your cause. That's the reward structure. But what is the reward though? Like when we really get beneath it, the reward really is your own ego. That's not the healthiest, most growth-oriented reward a human could have.
This brings us to an article that I read of yours in Scientific American diagnosing the ego as really the source of all our modern ills. Do you want to expand on that idea?
Yeah, and I define the ego specifically because there's a lot of definitions in psychology of ego and a lot of definitions of self. I view the ego as not the same thing as yourself. The ego is that part of yourself, that sort of set of values and representations and actions that has an incessant need to defend a positive image of yourself at all times. The ego has its own rationality to it. It has its own sort of structure. And when you're totally just dancing in the world of your ego, a lot of things make sense to you, even though you might be blowing up the whole world.
What are some examples of the way people do that?
So many things can activate those ego defenses. I mean, even the slightest criticism, this doesn't only happen in the level of individuals. I wrote an article for The Atlantic about this on the collective narcissism. This happens at the collective level as well. So even the slightest criticism of your group, like coming from the inside, everyone will look at that person as disloyal. I see that as a really big, 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 big problem. Like you're part of this group and you're like fighting for the cause, but you're like, well, hey guys, actually I think you went too far there. They'd be like, you're out. they're defending it at all costs. Like we'd rather like kick the person out than to even entertain the possibility we might not be perfect. And that happens at the individual level as well. If someone individually threatens us, the very same principles often apply at the individual level of narcissism with the group level of narcissism. Very same principles as I'm seeing everywhere. And at the individual level, it's like the very, you know, slightest sort of comment. And I'm not talking about trolling. I think we all dislike trolls. But even just someone who's might write a very thoughtful comment like, well, that's an interesting point you make, but I disagree with it. You know, I think that XYZ disagreement has now become World War III.
Yeah. Although there's also this, I do, but there's also this parallel thing that you're reminding me of where there's an elevation of the virtue of civility above all else. The reason I'm pausing is because I'm a bit of a champion of
disagreement.
Disagreement. Yeah.
Me too. Me too.
You know, you're right. I mean,
like, I know it's ironic.
I was amazed, not to keep banging on about Joe Rogan, but when I left the studio from doing Joe Rogan's show, I mentally, you know, asked myself in the Uber on the way to the airport. So, you know, have I said anything there that's going to blow up? You know, I've done his show 6 times before. I know what sort of catches fire, and I didn't want to cause trouble for my employer. And I scanned through, you know, a half dozen exchanges that could have gone viral, and I was like, I think they're pretty much okay. The exchange that ended up blowing up wasn't even one of those 6. So at the time, for me, it did not strike me as being at all heated that he and I had butted heads a little bit about some arcane side effect of the vaccine in adolescence, right? And then it took about a week for it to gain traction and to really explode. And what I found notable about the fact that that was the point, that was the moment that did go viral, was that it just showed how unwilling most people are just to have the basic modicum of self-respect to push back and disagree with other people. Like, I actually sort of think there's too much civility and politeness. Like, maybe it's my Australianness or something, but I just think we should be calling bullshit a lot more in much more blunt and friendly ways. Like, you know, not demonizing the person, but just, because I always say, if you were at a pub and your friend said something that was, that you were pretty sure was nonsense that they'd read online, you wouldn't just wait for them to stop talking, politely note your objection, and then move on. You'd interrupt them and go, mate, that's bullshit. At least I would. Wouldn't you? No, and wouldn't that bullshit. Be an appropriate way to joust?
No, I mean, I think that's bullshit, what you're saying. Totally bullshit. I hear what you're saying. I'm trying to think of what it, like, again, like, that's my, like, what's an integration? Can multiple things be true at the same time? Can you point out that problem, but also point to the problem that disagreement seems to be equated with hate these days as well? I feel like,
so that's,
I feel
sort
like
of what, that's are, the same thing, isn't it? Aren't those the same thing?
Two sides of the same coin.
Like, I'm saying that people, I'm saying that people are afraid that they're going to come across as being full of hate for simply intellectually disagreeing with someone.
I think they're afraid of that because that's what happens.
Right.
So okay, cool. So I think we have it figured out here again for a second. So I agree with you, but I think the reason what's holding people back from being more like that, like the friend at the pub, is that we're seeing such a sensitivity these days that if you do act like that friend at the pub, you immediately get treated like you are the devil. And so I think that's we are agreeing on the same thing, just coming from different points.
And then being excluded from the group, I like the fact that you said earlier, like, this, the threat of having someone say you're out of the tribe is keenly felt at the moment. And what that then makes me think is that we've also got this ecosystem at the moment where the outsiders are themselves a tribe. Like you mentioned Brett Weinstein, right? Mm-hmm. There's this whole kind of groupthink going on between, you know, I think of Brett Weinstein, I think of Majid Nawaz, I think of Tim mm-hmm. Pool, I think of, like, people from all across the ideological spectrum, Dave Rubin, mm-hmm. who have come together in this, like, we're sort of edgy outsiders who don't take any bullshit from the mainstream, and that itself has become a tribe that you can get excommunicated from, as the likes of, I suppose, Sam Harris and I, if we were ever in it, have become excluded from. And so even the anti-tribe becomes its own tribe, and even the non-conformist becomes the conformist.
It's also weird because you're right. I mean, it's all tribes. Like, as much as I try to be like, I am tribeless, like, if you had to, like, force me, I'd be in you and Sam's tribe. Like,
yeah, that's right. And now we're in a little mini tribe that's been excluded from the from the tribe that was excluded from the other tribes.
It's true. I talked to Sam about this very topic, and
it's
very true. It's very true. And even when I don't, no matter how hard you try to not be in a tribe, we live in a body, a human. We're humans, and humans are tribal, and it's almost incomprehensible for us to view people in any other way. And that's a huge problem. But I do think a big part of my mission and my project in Transcendence is being able to harness this kind of mindset that Maslow called dichotomy transcendence. It's not a phrase that ever caught on, but I think it's a really brilliant form of transcendence, where we really are able to think outside of these kind of lots of these dichotomies we have in our society that can be transcended if we can just reach that kind of aspect of consciousness.
How?
Oh boy. The theory is easier to roll off the tongue than the practical how to, but, you know, so much of it is shift in perspective, and starts from within. Really, it starts from cultivating spiritual practices within your own self that you practice on a regular basis that get you outside of that way of thinking. I mean, I'm a big fan of Sharon Salzberg. Like, she's my spiritual mentor. We have Zoom chats, and I ask her a million questions.
Who's Sharon Salzberg?
Okay, Sharon Salzberg is a beautiful human. She is the modern day loving kindness meditation, you know, really like the leader in that whole way of bringing that those principles from the Buddha to the West. When I practice her loving kindness meditations or just read her writings and stuff, I really do see the world very differently. I do. I find I'm much gentler. I'm much more open to multiple perspectives and other ways of being. You know, so I really think that it takes practice. It's just like growth itself. You have to constantly choose the growth option. Love, you have to constantly choose love. Maybe sometimes I say love and you might roll your eyes because you think we should have more disagreement in the world. But again, that's dichotomy transcendence. Is I think we have disagreement and love as a higher order construct.
No, absolutely. In fact, Richard Dawkins says something that I always hold dear, which is that he says, "I respect you too much to pretend to respect your stupid opinions." There's actually a love that if I don't give a shit about someone and I have total contempt for them, then I'll let their bullshit slide because it's not worth the fight. If I'm fighting with you, I am. That is an expression of love from my perspective. I care about you enough to rescue you in a way intellectually, like that, or to engage with you. I want to hear your pushback against mine. Either I want to pull you out of an intellectual hole the way that I would practice tough love on a drug addict because I loved them, or I respect your point of view, and so I want to hear your ways of pushing back against mine in order to make mine better or perhaps abandon mine. I think that's my sense of bullshit detection and pushback is entirely consistent with your conception of love.
I agree. And I just want to say kudos to you for creating the podcast you did and just making that even in the title of your podcast. You're like, look, this is what's going to happen here, folks.
Yeah.
because people, you're right. And I'm glad that someone did it, right? My podcast is about something a little bit different, but I'm glad you did this. Like, I'm glad that this exists because we do live in this environment where it seems like everyone is like tiptoeing around each other. They're so scared of being canceled. Everyone's kind of like walking around in the circle of each other. No one's really engaging each other authentically. And they're kind of scared to engage authentically. And when that's what we need more in the world, we need, I would rather feel as though, and I personally do feel more respected when the person feels they can say anything to me. To me, that's a sense of, I do receive that as a sense of love and respect. Mm. When I feel like someone's tiptoeing around me, like they're so scared of saying anything to me that might hurt my feelings, then to me, that kind of signals that like, they think I'm like, really that weak, that are really like, I can't deal with the truth, or I can't.
Yeah.
There's something very distancing there.
If you were emperor of the world and you could snap your fingers and make one big change, big magical change of some kind, what would it be?
I think it would be to create a self-actualizing society where every human on this planet has the opportunities to realize their full potential. And
let me rephrase the question. Okay. Here's what you get when I give you, I'm your genie. Okay. Exactly. Yours was too big and too non-specific. You know,
like one thing, Scott.
One thing. Yeah. You know how they say that goal setting, you know, when you set goals for yourself, it has to be specific and measurable. Don't give me this bullshit about world peace, Gandhi. You have to pull a lever and something has to happen in the world. What is that thing that happens?
I feel like all my things are like so broad because I think about things I care deeply about in education as well, like offering accessible high quality education to all. Is that too small or too big? Is that too big as well?
Almost, but I mean, you could probably whittle it down. I mean, you could say, quadruple the funding of public education in America, or it could be something related to social media that we were talking about. You know, change the algorithm, or make Facebook never have happened, or it could be something about the way that people prevent people from.
But I think so much.
Brains that makes them not focus on the negative. And
I love all those things you're saying.
Express gratitude or whatever.
But I think why I go back to education, if that is the one, if I only get one thing, the point I want to try to make, you can help me, like, you know, the business plan for it, but because I know that's what you're talking to me like an investor, right? An investor,
yeah,
like, okay, that's great vision, yeah. But what's the profitability?
I'm your angel investor. Yeah, I need to see the
I know exactly what you're asking me, and I get it. And I just want to tell you where I'm coming from in my answer. I think that if I had to do one thing, the lever I would pull would start as young as possible, because I think that so many people are uneducated, so many people are so ignorant. So many people are not, they don't know how to think in a way that has an ounce of nuance. And I think education is such an important lever.
I'm trying to think about how much nuance and critical thinking skills I got from the formal school. Institutions of education. Yeah,
that's versus... why I said high quality. That's why I said, yeah, if we could offer, well, you're giving me the magic wand, so I'm saying,
yeah, you can have the magic. Yeah, okay, all right. Yeah, have
high
have
a, quality have a... education for all opportunity,
and high quality being defined as encouraging critical thinking.
No,
and
not
training.
Necessarily.
No.
I would. I'm talking more like self-actualization. So encouraging. And I understand why you said what you said, because I did say. You know, that there's so much ignorance and so on, but just like high quality education, I think would include the component of critical thinking. That would certainly be a component of it, but it would also signal for students that their own individual being matters, because we talked earlier about how so much of the fighting and everything stems from that need to matter. If we could create an education system where people felt within the structure of human knowledge they matter, I just think later on it would prevent so many problems.
There you go. There's your spreadsheet. There's Yay. Your investor manifesto. I'm investing.
Okay. You put me on the hot spot.
You've got the $100 trillion, Scott. Congratulations.
Okay, good,
handshake. Good. Scott, it's terrific to talk to you. We could do this for 3 hours, but I have to go and do a radio show. But perhaps good we luck. Can keep looping back intermittently, because there's an enormous amount to explore, and I'm looking forward to being on your show in a few weeks.
Can't wait to keep up the combo.
Uncomfortable Conversations is produced by Stefan Postuma. Follow me, Josh Sepps, on Twitter and Instagram for all the latest. May your day be fruitful, your mind humble, your enemies generous, and your conversations perfectly, sparklingly, delectably uncomfortable.